"Are you going to warn him about Mrs. Windermere yet?" said Lil. I set out again, dragging the wagon behind me. After 10 minutes, I had no idea how to find any of the streets on the map, and so I had to stop and ask someone who was edging the lawn in front of her house, like it really mattered to anyone if her grass was cut in a straight line. I held out the map and asked if she knew where the street was for the first house. She put down her edger, took off her garden gloves, and looked at the map. "That's Gardner. That's this street," she said. She pointed up at the sign on the corner. "Didn't you see it?"
"No, I didn't see it, jerk.
I wouldn't have asked you if I had seen it, would I?" That's what I wanted to say. "So number 19 would be," I said, "a few houses down on the other side. Evelyn Mason's place," she pointed. "It's the bright yellow one with the white impatiens under the porch." I headed down to Evelyn Mason's place with the stupid white impatiens under the stupid porch, knocked on the stupid door, handed over the stupid bags of groceries, showed her the stupid map and said, "I have to get over to," and she pointed the way. That's how I got by the rest of that Saturday morning. I showed the customers the map, and they pointed the way. It worked pretty well until Ernie Echo drove by, and he said, "What was I doing?" And I told him, and he asked if I needed help finding the houses, and I said I did, and he looked at the map and told me the way to the house after the one I was already heading to, but he told me to go in completely the wrong direction, and by the time I got that figured out and turned around and found the last house, their ice cream had mostly melted inside the foil bag, and they wouldn't pay for it. So I took it back. Mr. Spicer said it could happen on anyone's first day, but I shouldn't let it happen again, and next time he'd have to take it out of my salary. Ernie Echo probably thought he was a barrel of laughs. He probably thought I was a chump. Then Mr. Spicer nodded to the last wagon. "It's for Mrs. Windermere," he said. Lil whistled kind of low, like something out of the Twilight Zone. "Mrs. Windermere," I said.
"This one's got ice cream, too. Lemon ice cream, which is expensive. So pay attention."
I nodded. I wondered if he might hand me a cold Coke before I left. The mercury must have left 90 behind a long time ago, and I sure did know what to do with a really cold Coke.
"Mrs. Windermere is supposed to pay you," Mr. Spicer said, "cash on delivery. Sometimes she tries to charge it, but then she forgets, and I have to drive over and she's forgotten that she didn't pay, and we have a really unhappy scene. So make sure you come away with..." He looked down at her bill. $22.78.
"Okay," I said, waiting for a cold Coke. Waiting for a cold Coke. Waiting for a cold Coke.
"And you won't even need a map for this one," Mr. Spicer said. "Go over to the library, take the street that runs into it, that's Green Street, and head out until the houses stop and there's a big field. Go across that and you'll see this huge brick house. That's where she lives. Got it?"
$22.78, I said. Mr. Spicer nodded. "In hand," he said. "A Coke," I thought. "A really cold Coke with ice coming down the sides." He looked at me.
"You waiting for something?"
"I wouldn't be in a hurry either if I was him," Lil said. I set off on the last run of the Saturday deliveries. I decided that if I found any sprinklers going, I'd jump through them since everything I was wearing was already dripping wet anyway. But there weren't any sprinklers the whole way. Are you surprised? There never are. Do you know how many blocks there were before the houses started thinning out after the library? 14. Do you know how many trees there are along the road once the houses started to give out? 6. Do you know how much shade they gave? Maybe a tiny bit more than 0. Do you know how big that field before Mrs. Windermere's house was? Big. And the path that I had to drag the wagon on wasn't exactly mowed. By the time I got there,
I couldn't believe I was still sweating, since it felt like anything liquid must have baked out of me. I couldn't believe there was still frost on the metal foil around the expensive lemon ice cream. Mrs. Windermere's house spread out at the end of a long brick path, and the bricks were baking hot, that led up from the road through gardens on either side that had just been sprinkled with sprinklers, which were turned off now, of course, and then past some tall evergreens, and then into some high trees that finally spread some shade down into the world, and then through some more gardens with flowers that I would have died to bring home to my mother, and finally more baked bricks right up to the house. It was the biggest house I'd ever seen that one person owned. I mean, there were pillars in the front. Pillars! More windows than Camillo Junior High. This green and white ivy climbing up everywhere. And a doorway with a round window over it. That's right, over it. No one could even look out of it. It was that high up. It was quiet under the trees. No wind. The only thing I heard was someone pecking at a typewriter, and then the little bell dinging when whoever was typing reached the end of a line. But nothing else. It was like even the birds knew they had to be quiet. Because I guess no one was supposed to disturb the great Mrs. Windermere. I left the wagon at the foot of the steps that led up to the door, and I rang the doorbell and stepped back. Typing, not stopping. Little bell still dinging. I waited for a while. Typing, not stopping. Little bell still dinging. I went up and rang the doorbell again. Twice. Knocked. Twice. Typing, stopping. I took a step back, which turned out to be a really good thing because the door suddenly swung open and there was Mrs. Windermere. At least, I figured it had to be her. She had hair as white as clouds, and about as wispy, too, and big. It was all gathered like one of those huge thunderheads that rises on hot summer days. The top was in sort of a bun, and tied tight with red rubber bands. And in that top bun, I'm not lying, there were three bright yellow pencils stabbing through. She wore a bluish kind of gown that shimmered. It looked like something that someone about to go to an opera would wear, not that I've ever been to an opera or would ever be caught dead at one. Can you imagine Joe Pepitone ever going to an opera? With the cloud on top and the shimmering blue beneath, she looked like a rainstorm that could walk around all by itself. Which wouldn't have been so bad on a day that wanted to be 100 degrees. All this, by the way, took about a half a second to see, because she hadn't even finished opening the door when she said, "Who are you?" That's not really what she said. She used a word that I'd never heard a lady use before. It came pretty close after who. You can figure it out for yourself. "Who do you think I am?" I said. I know, sounding like Lucas. But you have to remember that she started it. And it was hot. And Mr. Spicer had never given me that really cold Coke. Ice coming down the sides. She looked behind me at the wagon. "I think you are a very skinny and very rude delivery boy, and you are a very skinny and very rude delivery boy whom I have no time for right now. Go away and come back later this afternoon." She closed the door. Hard. Typing starting up again. Little bell dinging. I could almost hear Lil snorting back at the deli. I stood out there for a couple of minutes. To be as thirsty as I was, you'd have to be in the French Foreign Legion and lost somewhere out in the Sahara for a week. I thought about dragging that wagon back down the baking brick walk and through the fields to the road. I thought about dragging that wagon down all of those 14 blocks back to Spicer's Deli. And then I thought about doing it all over again in the afternoon. I rang the doorbell. Typing not stopping, little bell still dinging.
I rang the doorbell again. Twice. Knocked. Twice. Stepped back. Typing stopping, and this time the door opened even more quickly.
"Do you know what creativity is?" Mrs. Windermere said.
"You have to admit, this is not something you expect a normal person to say." "I'm not sure," I said.
"I'm sure that you do not know, or you would not be ringing this doorbell. Creativity is a god who comes only when he pleases, and it isn't very often. But when he does come, he sits beside my desk and folds his wings, and I offer him whatever he wants, and in exchange, he lets me type all sorts of things that get turned into plays for which people who own New York stages are waiting. And right now, he is sitting by my desk, and he is being very kind. So if you would go away and..."
"Suppose you offer him some ice cream," I said. "Would he stay longer?" She looked behind me again at the wagon.
"Ice cream?" she said.
I nodded.
"What kind did I order?"
"Lemon." She considered this.
"Lemon,"
she said. I nodded again. She looked at the wagon once more.
"Go around back. There's a door into the kitchen. Put everything away where it's supposed to go. If you cannot figure out where something is supposed to go, for heaven's sake, don't come and ask me. Leave it on the kitchen table. You better start with the ice cream. And do not make any noise."
She closed the door again. Hard again. I followed the brick path around the house to the back. I should tell you that there was no shade around the side of the house, so things were getting sort of desperate in the thirsty department. The kitchen door was up 3 steps, so I grabbed the ice cream and headed up. The door was locked. Of course. Of course it was locked. I thought about going around and ringing the doorbell again. I thought about walking away and leaving the whole thing right there. Melted lemon ice cream all over the back steps. Instead, I looked under the mat by the door, and there it was. The key. Pretty sneaky of Mrs. Windermere. No one would ever think to look there if he wanted to break in while she was away at the opera. Here are the stats for Mrs. Windermere's kitchen. The floor was white and yellow tile, 24 tiles wide, 18 tiles long. One rack with 16 copper pots and pans hanging over a woodblock table. 4 yellow stools around the woodblock table. 12 glass cupboards, all white inside. You could have put my mother's dishes into any one of these and you would have had plenty of room left over. And the dishes, all white and yellow. And the glasses, who knows how many, all matching, not a single one chipped. You know who deserved this kitchen, right? Before I did anything, I drank about a gallon and a half from the faucet. I put my head under and let the water run. I didn't even care if Mrs. Windermere came in and saw me doing it. It wasn't like I was using one of her glasses. And it tasted so good, even better than a really cold Coke. Then I put all the groceries away, starting with the lemon ice cream into the freezer. I left the fresh beans and carrots and onions on the woodblock table, but everything else got put away in cupboards that, if you asked me, were pretty full already. But no one was asking me. I took another long drink for the road, another gallon and a half, I'd say. Then I started out the back door and remembered. $22.78. I could hear the typing and the dinging through the house. They were going pretty steady. Probably the god creativity was still being good to her. But I needed the $22.78. I swung open the door out of the kitchen and went into a dining room. It was cool and dark and full of roses, big red ones on black wallpaper, and big red ones in a vase in the middle of a dark table that looked like it should be in a museum or something.
I followed the sound of the typing and the dinging. Down a long, long hall with walls hung with framed photographs of actors and actresses, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, and Yul Brynner with his bald head, and Telly Savalas with his bald head, and Danny Kaye and Lucille Ball even, all posing on stages. Then the hall let into a bright sitting room, all yellow and white again. And then down another short hall there was a glass door with diamond panes, and behind that I could see Mrs. Windermere typing wildly. Sometimes her hands went high above her shoulders before they dropped down to smack at the keys. And by the way, there wasn't any god sitting on the chair by her desk with his wings folded. He couldn't have sat there if he wanted to. The chair was filled with books, most of them lying open, one on top of another. I waited before knocking at the glass door. I'm not lying. Her typing was a sight to see. But I couldn't stand there forever, so I knocked. Typing not stopping, little bell still dinging, I knocked again, twice. Without turning around, she waved her hand to shoo me away. So I knocked again. Both hands up above her shoulders this time, both hands dropping down to the typewriter, she turned around, slowly. There was this look on her face that, well, if she had reached for one of the sharp pencils stabbed through her bun, I would have been gone. "What is it now?" she said. "I have the bill," I said. $22.78. You have to remember that we were talking through the door here, which made the whole thing kind of weird. It was like I was talking through glass to some sort of prison inmate. "Put it on my account," she said. She turned back to the typewriter to sort out all the keys that were jammed together now. "I can't," I said. "Mr. Spicer wants me to bring the cash back to him." She was working over her typewriter. "Mrs. Windermere," I said. "Ah," she said. "I'm not lying. Ah," just like that. Then she stood up and grabbed the door handle, which was glass too, by the way, and threw the door open. "You fix the typewriter keys," she said. "I'll get the money." I went into the room. It was bigger than I had thought. Its walls kept going back and back, and every wall had dark wood bookshelves to the ceiling, and every bookshelf was crammed. Out on the floor there was a round table heaped with books. Beside that was a dark couch covered with rows of books. Everywhere on the floor, piles of books leaned into each other. On the sides of her desk and in front of her desk, more piles leaning. I never thought that one person could own so many books. I picked one up off the desk and smelled its pages. The smell of old paper. I worked at separating the keys in her typewriter. I found out pretty quickly that the trick is to take one key at a time and just let the ink get all over your hands, and I got most of them done by the time Mrs. Windermere got back. She threw $25 at me. "I don't think I have any change," I said. "Keep it," she said. "Splurge. Go on a shopping spree. Book a trip to Monte Carlo. Do whatever you want, but do it away from me. Here, stop fussing with that. You'll just get everything all inky." She took over the typewriter keys, and I think by the time I backed out of the room with the $25, she had forgotten I was there. $2.22. It was the only tip I had gotten all day, but it was a good one. $2.22. Do you know what you can do with $2.22? I had never had that much money all my own. $2.22. So maybe it was because I was thinking about the $2.22 that I turned the wrong way in the short hall and got into a room I hadn't been in before. It was all light blues with white furniture and a white fireplace with small stone lions on either side and another vase on a dark table filled with pink roses. And over the fireplace, a huge picture of birds, the same size as the one of the Arctic tern. And by John James Audubon again, you could tell. But this one was different. One bird was the mother. Two were swimming away, doing what they felt like doing, not even looking at her. And there was this small bird, pretty young. It was looking like maybe it wanted to swim where the other two birds were, but maybe not. And anyway, he was afraid to try. And the mother? Her neck was turned all around about as far as it could possibly go. And she was looking far away, at something a long way out from the picture. She was looking at a place she wanted to go but couldn't, because she didn't know how to get away. There were flowers beside her. I stood there looking at that picture for a long time, even after the typing and dinging started up again. The little one didn't know what he wanted to do at all. I reached up and touched the glass over it. Cold. Then I found the kitchen again, went out, locked the door behind me, and hid the key in its so-secret spot that no one would ever think to look in. I wiped my inky hands on the grass and dragged the wagon back to Spicer's Deli. When I pulled the wagon inside, Mr. Spicer looked at his watch, then at me like I hadn't been paying attention. "Did you see Mrs. Windermere?" said Lil. "Yep," I said. I handed Mr. Spicer the $25. He counted it, took it to the register, and paid out my tip. "Pretty nice," he said. I nodded. "Well," said Lil. "Well, what?" I said. "I pay salary every other Saturday," Mr. Spicer said. "Okay," I said. I still had my $2.22 in hand. "That's fine." "I know. I'm a chump."
"So what happened?" said Lil.
Then Mr. Spicer handed me a Coke. "You remember, right, that I know what to do with a really cold Coke?" I did it. Except the burp, since Mr. Spicer was right there. "Not a thing," I said when I finished.
"You skinny thug," said Lil.
I handed her the bottle. I burped when I got out onto the street. I'm not lying. It was a pretty good one. Birds flew out of the maples. I put the $2.22 in my pocket and went up to the library. Mrs. Merriam looked at me, then went back to whatever she'd been working at to let me know that I wasn't worthy of Her Majesty's attention. So what? So what? It wasn't like I needed her attention. I just came to the library to see if I could get that beak right, which I probably couldn't on account of how I don't draw, like I told Mr. Powell. So what? I went upstairs. The lights were on. Mr. Powell hadn't turned the page of the book. It was still open to the Arctic tern. But there was one thing that was different. There were three large blank sheets of paper on the glass display case, and there were five colored pencils, gray, black, green, blue, and orange. Dark orange. They were all sharp. There was an eraser, too, waiting like I had ordered them. I ran my hand over the glass on top of the Arctic tern. Then I left. I didn't touch anything, since I don't draw. Remember? That night at supper, my father asked if I started the job. I nodded. Did I get paid? Tips. Tips? That's all? Tips? Didn't I get paid for the day? I told him I got paid every other Saturday. He told me I was a chump, and he and my brother laughed at me like I was the jerk of the world, like I was never going to see any of that money, like I was about as useless as a rubber crutch. My mother turned and looked out the window at something far away. That next week, I ran into Lil Spicer three times. The first two times, I looked like a chump. The first time, I'd finally jumped under a sprinkler because it was so hot, the sidewalks were white and shimmering, and if there was any place within 10 miles to go swimming, I didn't know about it. I guess I got desperate. So I jumped under a sprinkler not so far from the library, and it was perfect. And I had just come out from under it when, of course, Lil Spicer turned the corner on her bike, looking as cool as if she had been in Monte Carlo or something. As soon as she saw me, she started to laugh. "Did you fall into a pool?" she said. It took her a while to say this, since she was mostly snorting. "No, I didn't fall into a pool," I said. "Did you?" "You did. You went under a sprinkler." I didn't say anything. What would you have said? "You trying to stay cool by running under sprinklers? Just like when you were a cute little boy instead of a skinny thug." "Yes, I'm trying to stay cool." "I suppose that's one way to do it." "Yes, it's one way to do it." Lil Spicer started to laugh again. "It's a pretty dumb way," she said. "Thanks for pointing that out," I said, and went on down the white-hot sidewalk, wishing that I wasn't squishing so much. You're leaving footprints," she pointed out. She was laughing so hard she was almost crying. "I hate this town." The second time was on Friday. I was heading toward the library, and yes, I know it's not open on Friday, but who knows if a miracle might happen and it would be open after all. So I was heading to the library, and when I turned the corner, there, two blocks away, was my brother, with a new group of criminals. It hadn't taken him long. They were in front of Spicer's Deli, probably figuring out how to rob it. My brother sat on a stingray that wasn't his. I guess it belonged to some weaker member of the pack, and he was probably talking about how hard life was where we had come from, and how he'd been in knife fights that were for real, and how he'd even seen a teacher get knifed, which was all a lie. But when he pulled up his shirt and showed the long scar he had gotten from climbing over a fence, which was what he was doing right now, pulling up his shirt, who could tell it wasn't a scar from a blade? I moved back into the shadows beneath the tall maples in front of the library. I didn't move. That's how packs detect you. You move, they see you out of the corners of their beady yellow eyes, and then they swarm for the kill. Which was why I did not move when I felt a large, wet, sloppy plop drop down from the branches overhead. Large isn't the right word, and drop isn't either. Think pour down for drop down, and you have it about right. There was a rustle, and a crow flew away, grinning. I did not move. The plop slimed down my hair, over my ear, and then along my neck and into the collar of my t-shirt, and still I didn't move. I waited. I could feel the bird poop starting to crust over in the heat, and still I didn't move. I waited until finally, Mr. Spicer came out and hollered, and my brother hollered back and stood up on his stingray. He was really pretty good at balancing on the thing, and then he looked my way. I think my heart stopped. I almost panicked and moved. But someone must have said something, probably God, and so he turned and headed the other way on his bike, hollering once more at Mr. Spicer before he left, the jerk. My heart started up again. I waited in the shadows until he biked around the corner with the rest of the pack, and then I reached up to wipe off the bird poop.
Except before I got to it, I heard Lil's voice.
Did you know that half of your head is covered in bird droppings? She said.
It's not bird droppings, I said.
It's not?
Dropping. It's one dropping, not droppings. It's not like I stood here and let this army of birds poop on me.
So you stood there and let only one bird poop on you. Good for you.
I didn't let it poop on me.
Oh, she said.
Do you know how she said, oh? It wasn't like she was figuring something out and had just gotten it. It was like she was saying that I was the jerk of the world, which I had been hearing a lot lately.
It sure is a mess, she said. When you have hair as black as yours, it really shows well.
Thanks, I said.
Do you need some help cleaning it up? She said.
By the way, and not that I think you're not too smart or anything, but I just want to make sure. You do know that she wasn't really offering to help, right?
No, I said. I don't need any help.
If you ask me, she said, pushing her bike past, you are someone who needs a lot of help. She turned and looked back at me.
Maybe you should try going under a sprinkler, she said, and smiled helpfully.
I smiled back and watched her ride away. Then I reached up and felt the bird poop in my hair. It was crusty, all right, but it was still sticky enough to smear. I rubbed as much as I could out of my hair and onto my fingers and then onto the grass. I didn't get much out before it all hardened. So I did go under a sprinkler on the way home. It wasn't a bad idea. The third time, I didn't look like a chump, at first. I was spading up a place for a garden in front of the dump, and I'm not lying, this was hard work, since no one had spaded up this ground since forever. It took all morning, but I had almost finished when Lil Spicer came riding up on her bike. In her basket, she's got these plants. It was the eeriest thing. It was like we'd had the same dream or something.
Hi, she said.
Hi, I said.
My mother sent these over, she said.
How did you know I was digging up a garden?
Lil got off her bike and put down the kickstand. My mother is weird like that when it comes to plants. She knows.
She reached into her basket and held them up. Daisies, she said.
They were long, and bright white blossoms fell out of the damp newspaper. We planted them together and watered them, and then tightened the soil around them. It means something, you know, when people plant things together. By the time we were done, these daisies were strutting their white hearts out in front of the dump, which didn't look quite so much like a dump anymore.
My hands are all dirty, Lil said. I almost reached out to hold them. I think she would have let me.
How come, when you're feeling good like this, something always happens to wreck it all? How come?
So we're standing there, Lil and me, Lil holding her hands out, and my brother, my jerk brother, comes riding up on his stingray. He gets off and looks at the daisies. Then he looks at us.
Nice, he says.
Thanks, says Lil, because she doesn't know yet that he's a jerk. And she doesn't know, like you know, that he's not really saying they're nice.
Looks like they need some water, he says.
My stomach starts to twist up. They're fine, I say.
We've already watered them, says Lil.
Not enough, says my jerk brother. And he walks over and stands next to them. He leans down over the first flower
and lets fall a glob of spit, about as big as the bird poop. It falls right into the flower, and its head bobs down with the weight. Then my jerk brother leans over to the next flower. He lets fall another glob of spit. Lil gets on her bike and rides away. My brother spits on every one of the flowers. Big globs that he hacks up from deep in his lungs somewhere. "Looks a lot better now, don't you think, Duggo?" I stood there like a chump. You see how things never go right when you're feeling good? You see how things never go right when you're feeling good, said my father that night. You work like a freaking dog and get ahead in production because you've been doing a great job. And so you take a few more minutes for lunch to relax a little. Who cares? You're still making your quota, so who freaking cares? But it turns out that Mr. Big Bucks Ballard cares, and he lays into you for coming back late, like it's going to cost him a whole dollar and a half. We don't get things done around here by coming back late, he says to me when I come in. Try not to make it a habit. I'll make it a freaking habit if I feel like making it a habit, I almost said to him. And stuff like that, through the meatloaf and green beans and canned peaches. Who does he think he is? Said my father. I almost said that maybe Mr. Big Bucks Ballard thinks he's my father's boss, but I'm not an idiot. My father's hands were twitching like they wanted to flash out, and I didn't want them to flash out my way, so I shut up and ate, which is what he would have told me to do if I had said anything anyway. My mother mostly looked out the window. Things never go right when you're feeling good, my father said again. After my father and my brother left, I helped my mother bring the dishes into the kitchen. Thanks for the meatloaf, Mom, I said. Thanks for the daisies, she said. I'll dry, I said. That smile. The next Saturday's deliveries went better, mostly because I remembered the routes. Evelyn Mason on Gardner was waiting for me at the back door, which she held open as I carried her bags of groceries in and put them on the kitchen counter. You're so skinny, she said. I think that's everything, I said. I want you to sit right down there and pour yourself a glass of milk, she said. Then she opened up the box of cinnamon donuts I had delivered. You don't know how much I love cinnamon donuts. I had two with a glass of milk. Evelyn Mason looked as happy as I probably looked. I'll order some chocolate donuts for next week, she promised. I didn't tell her not to. On the next run, I got turned around and had to ask a mailman where the Leffler house was. I showed him my map. You need to be on Washington Street, he said. It's parallel to this one, but two blocks that way. When I got there, Mr. Leffler was sitting on his front porch with a light bulb in his hand. He stood up when he saw me turn the corner. Exactly who I've been waiting to see, he said. I'm not late, I said. No, no. I just need someone to change the bulb over the back door. I'm a little shaky on ladders, you know. I changed the light bulb while he held the ladder. I climbed down and looked at him. He looked a little shaky on the ground, too. Anything else? I said. We went all over his house and changed 6 light bulbs. He must have spent a lot of time in the dark. That's just great, he said. He was pleased as all get out, you could tell. He handed me a dollar bill. For services rendered, he said. On the last run in town, I went to the Dohertys first. They were the people whose ice cream had melted last Saturday. Mrs. Doherty met me at the back door. 5 kids watched through the screen while she inspected the ice cream straight off. Did the ice cream melt again? The littlest one asked her mother. No, Phronsie, not this time.
That's good, Phronsie said to me, because if it was melted, then Ben and Joel and Davy said they were going to have to kill you.
I looked at the three boys. They smiled at me. Not really, they said. Don't be too sure, Mrs. Daugherty said to me. And when all that was done, I had to head out to Mrs. Windermere's. It was a load pretty much like last week's, a little more, at $23.65. Don't forget the money, said Mr. Spicer, and I promised I wouldn't.
Don't ever turn your back, said Lil.
Lillian, said Mr. Spicer.
I warned you, she said.
It was a day more than hot enough to make you work up a sweat. But the blue of the air went forever. And when the houses gave out and the road passed into the open field and there was just the sound of cicadas, Marysville didn't seem so bad. Except it would have been a whole lot better with a really cold Coke. Or if Joe Pepitone and I were walking side by side trading stories, and then we stopped for a while and threw in the field with the cicadas. That would have been even better. That would have been a whole lot better. So I was looking out into the field, thinking about throwing with Joe Pepitone, and then this thing happened. Maybe the god of creativity flew by and brushed me with his wing. I don't know. But suddenly, out in the field, it wasn't Joe Pepitone I was throwing with. It was Lucas, which, just so you know, would never have happened. But I could see us, Lucas back from Vietnam and me, throwing out in the field on a blue summer day, like that, throwing back and forth, and the sound of cicadas and bees and high-up birds and the leather smell of our gloves and the ball smacking into them. Lucas laughing in the sun. It was almost like seeing a ghost. I got to Mrs. Windermere's, and I could hear her typing and dinging, so I went around to the back door and found the cleverly hidden key and brought in her groceries and put them away, starting with the ice cream. Then I swung open the kitchen door and headed into the house to get the $23.65. I followed the sound of her typing and dinging until I could see her through the glass door, typing madly in another opera dress. Pencils still stabbed through her hair. Hands flying like birds in a panic. But before I knocked, I went into the blue room. I don't know how long I stood there, staring at the picture. I didn't even hear the typing and dinging stop, or Mrs. Windermere coming into the room.
"Aren't they beautiful?" she said.
I nodded.
"What kind of ice cream did I order this week?"
"Peppermint." "What kind of birds are they?"
"Audubon called them red-throated divers. They're a sort of loon. It's a lovely family group, I think."
"Peppermint?" "Some family," I said. "No one's paying attention to the mother. Who could blame her if she took off? Look at them." A minute or so went by, and then Mrs. Windermere said, in a voice as soft as summer blue air,
"Skinny delivery boy, you have it all wrong. Look how she's standing close to her little one. She's looking around to watch for the next spectacular thing that's going to come into his life."
And I'm not lying. She was right. After dropping off the wagon and pocketing $10 for my pay, plus Mr. Leffler's dollar, plus a $1.35 tip from Mrs. Windermere, and drinking a really cold Coke with Lil, and not telling her a thing about Mrs. Windermere no matter how hard she tried to make me, and not burping until I got out on the street, I went to the library.
Mrs. Merriam glanced up when I came in.
"Oh, it's you," she said in that disgusting thing on the bottom of my shoe kind of voice.
I went upstairs. The lights were on, and Mr. Powell was standing by the glass case. He looked up at me as I came over. The three blank sheets of paper were still there, and there was another pencil, a light blue. I moved the sheets over and looked down at the Arctic tern. Those sharp wings, the neck, the beak, everything dropping toward the cold, cold sea. The terrified eye. I let my hand follow the lines over the glass. I stopped over the eye. My fingers moved.
"I don't think I know your name yet," said Mr. Powell.
"Doug Swiatek."
Mr. Powell held up the black pencil.
"Mr. Swiatek, would you like to try to draw it?" he asked.
"I don't know how," I said.
"Then let's begin," said Mr. Powell. And I'm not lying.
When I took the black pencil in my fingers, it felt spectacular.
Chapter 3. The Large-Billed Puffin. Plate 293. Okay. So I was going to the library every Saturday. So what? So what? It's not like I was reading books or anything. I went every Saturday because I had a lot to get in. There were only 3 weeks left in August, and then a few days in September before stupid Washington Irving Junior High School of stupid Marysville, New York, was scheduled to open its stupid doors and suck us away from summer. Only 3 weeks, and there was a lot to learn.
"We'll start with contour lines," Mr. Powell said that first Saturday.
"Put your hand up on the paper."
"No."
"Higher up.
The paper is the same size as the page in Audubon's book, so you want to try for the same proportions. Look at the turn."
"Good.
Now draw the outline of the bird."
"You don't need to look at your paper. Bring your line down from that first tip.
Not quite so slowly.
Bring it all the way down to the beak."
I brought the line all the way down to the beak.
"Now,
start on the right side and let's do the same thing. Bring the line all the way down to the beak. Don't look at the paper.
That's it."
"How am I going to make the lines meet if I don't look at the paper?"
"You're not."
I finished the right side of the bird, then looked at the paper.
"It doesn't look like much of a bird," I said.
"Not yet, it doesn't."
"It looks more like I'm showing what isn't the bird."
Mr. Powell put his hand over mine and stopped it. I looked up at him, and he had this smile. It wasn't like my mother's smile, but it was okay.
"That's right, Mr. Swiatek," he said. "That's exactly what you're doing. Most young artists take a long time to understand that.
Let's try it again.
Turn the sheet over.
This time, let's go a little faster with the lines. And as you start, that's it, right there. As you start, think about how the line is sending out information about the bird. How is the air moving over the feathers? How are the feathers stirring? How fast is the bird traveling?"
"Fast," I said.
"Keep that in mind as you bring the line down." I brought the line down.
"Stop," Mr. Powell whispered.
"You're about to come to the front edge of the wing, right?"
I nodded.
"Think about how the air is hitting that edge."
"Okay. You're probably not going to believe this, but when I did think about it, I really could feel the air right on my shoulders. I'm not lying."
Press down harder on your pencil to show how it feels.
I did.
Harder. You won't break the point.
Harder.
The right side, same thing.
I did it again.
Mr. Powell nodded. Now, Mr. Swiatek, let's bring in the neck and the head and beak. We'll let this white space here between the wing lines be the body. So imagine the neck extending out of that space. Put your pencil where you're going to begin. Very good. Now bring your line down a little faster. Audubon worked with curves on this bird, so that's what you're going to want to work with. Let it come around. Yes, just so. Now, bring your pencil to where you're going to start on the right side. No, look at the picture. You see how Audubon started this wing down a little lower? Why do you think he did that?
Because if the wings were at the same height, he'd look like he was hanging stuffed in a museum somewhere.
Mr. Powell smiled again.
You're talking about something called composition. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Draw the right line. A little faster.
We filled all three sheets of paper, front and back.
And I think we could have filled a whole bunch more if Mrs. Merriam hadn't come up and reminded Mr. Powell that there were other patrons of the Marysville Free Public Library, not to mention all the cataloging for those new books from Houghton Mifflin, and she couldn't do that by herself and check books in and out also, could she?
Of course not, said Mr. Powell, even though she probably could if she just put her looped glasses on and got to it.
End of your first lesson, said Mr. Powell.
He looked over the drawings.
Take this one home, he said. Here's something a little advanced for you, but I'm curious. See if you can figure out how to draw in the feathers. Think of it as a problem to be solved.
He rolled the paper up into a scroll and handed it to me.
Take the pencils. I'll clean the rest up later. Right now, I've got to go cataloging.
When I came down into the cool of the library that afternoon, it was only 3:30, and no one else was in the whole place as far as I could see, so I don't know what Mrs. Everything Has to Be Cataloged This Second Merriam was all fussed up about. Along the line of my thumb, there was a dark streak from the pencil. I decided I wouldn't wash my hands for a while to see if I could make it last.
By the way, in case you weren't paying attention or something, did you catch what Mr. Powell called me?
Young artist.
I bet you missed that. That night, I worked on the feathers before my brother came up to bed, which wasn't easy, because I didn't have a desk, so I had to use the floor. And I didn't have much time because my brother could come up any second, like during some Marlboro commercial, and he'd find me on the floor and he'd say, "What do you think you're doing?" And it wouldn't matter what I said because he'd tear the paper into shreds and they'd be outside in some gutter like Joe Pepitone's hat. So I had to work fast. I started on the left wing and I figured out that I could get these thin lines by angling the pencil tip. I tried to remember the rows on the turn, how the feathers on the wings got larger as they moved down, how they slanted a little bit into the body, how they kind of jumbled together above the long tail feathers. How the feathers were different, rounder, before they suddenly speared into the tail. How the wing feathers were long and sharp, but the feathers on the body were like whispers.
You think it's easy trying to remember all that?
You think it's easy trying to draw all that?
It isn't.
I messed up the whole left wing. I think I got the rows right, but I got all the feather lines too close or something, and so when I curved them around, they looked like a kid in kindergarten practicing his sixes. You couldn't imagine them brushing against the air. I tried the feathers on the body, and I think I got those okay. You had to use the lightest stroke, the very lightest. But even though it looked good from far away, The closer in you got, the worse it was. I started on the right wing, and the whole thing looked messed up again, until I finally figured it out. You can't draw every feather. You can't. I bet you hadn't thought of that either. So for the bottom rows of the bigger feathers, I drew just a few lines and curved them in. And I think it was right. You could imagine these feathers moving in the air. You really could. I looked at the feathers and rolled the paper up to hide it beneath my bed, and unrolled it to look at the feathers again, and finally rolled it up and hid it beneath the bed. Then I turned out the light and lay down with my hands, with a pencil smudge on my thumb, back behind my head, and I looked out the window. There was still a little bit of light left in the summer sky, and the birds were having a riot before turning in. A few stars starting up. I couldn't keep myself from smiling. I couldn't. Maybe this happens to you every day, but I think it was the first time I could hardly wait to show something that I'd done to someone who would care besides my mother. You know how that feels? So that's why I went to the Marysville Free Public Library every Saturday for the rest of August and on into September. Not to read a book or anything. September. Washington Irving Junior High School. The first Monday of September was the night for all the new kids coming to Washington Irving Junior High School to get acquainted, which meant a whole bunch of seventh graders who had probably lived in stupid Marysville their whole lives and one eighth grader who had moved to town that summer. Me. Terrific. I went with my mother, who got all dressed up like she was heading for mass and who held my hand until we got close, when people might see. Washington Irving Junior High School looked like the same people who built the Marysville Free Public Library built it. Six steps, again, and columns on each side of the door, and then marble floors once you got inside, which made everything cold and echoey. We all headed into the auditorium, and everyone seemed to know everyone else, probably because they had all been in the same elementary school since first grade. Even the mothers, who were all wearing these dresses that looked a whole lot cooler than what my mother was wearing, acted like they had all known one another since forever. We sat pretty much by ourselves. Didn't talk. My mother took off her hat and held it in her hands. She took off her gloves, too. At 7 o'clock, the principal got up and welcomed us all to an exciting new year of growth and opportunity at Washington Irving Junior High School. His name was Principal Petey. I'm not lying. And Principal Petey was there to keep us all in line, he said. We were supposed to laugh politely at that, and all the mothers did, even mine, after she saw she was supposed to. Principal Petey would like to introduce the teachers, he said, so the whole front row of them stood and turned toward us. There were only a couple of teachers who looked happy to be introduced. The rest looked like they knew they still had a few days of summer freedom coming, and they sure didn't want to start thinking about school any more than we did. After they sat down, Principal Petey announced the school theme for the year. Washington Irving J.H., catch the spirit! And then he called on a bunch of ninth graders who were all wearing the same orange T-shirt with the school theme on the back. Washington Irving J.H., catch the spirit! And they handed out a stack of dittos, and for the next 30 minutes, Principal Petey stood on the stage and read them to us. The heat trapped inside the auditorium during the whole stupid summer turned up a degree or two with each new ditto. After that, when even the ninth graders who had caught the stupid spirit were pretty much drooping, Principal Petey announced that parents were to stay in the auditorium for an informational session on school expectations, as well as a discussion of what supplies they were to provide
in a year of austerity budgets. Students, meanwhile, were to go to other classrooms for small group sessions.